you mine Frozbozzes and then turn them into Gloobledorps or something, right?
This is Up Up Down Down, a show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now my co-founder at Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Soren Johnson. Soren is a designer and developer known for his work on games like Civilization 3 and 4 and Spore, and most recently shipped the new real-time strategy game Off-World Trading Company. Hi, Soren.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Very exciting. Both of us are quite into strategy games, me in particular, and I feel like it's been a little bit of a... we haven't covered a lot on the show, and to have somebody like yourself who's had had a lot of experience thinking about the genre and how to make it work is an awesome opportunity. So that's our topic for today, is making strategy games.
All right. Well, I know a little bit about that.
A little bit. So I'm sure we'll kind of explore around some of the history, and you know, it'll be hard for Civilization to not come up.
Sure.
But how about we start off with a little bit of an intro to kind of give us a high level on Off-World Trading Company, which congratulations on shipping, or as shipping is now often called, is leaving early access. But congrats on putting a stamp on it and getting it out there. I've been hearing good things so far.
Cool. Thank you. So Offworld's it's an economic RTS set on Mars. And what that means is it's an RTS that focuses on what people sometimes call the macro part of the game. In RTS games, there's sort of like the macro element, which is managing your resources and your buildings and what you're making. And then there's the micro part, which is controlling all your units and your armies and the combat. And we just threw away all the micro, you know, just got rid of it. It's interesting because games like League of Legends and Dota and you know, basically all the MOBA games, in some ways you can kind of look at them as RTS games that are purely about micro.
Yeah, totally. That's what they feel like, or the origins of them, right?
Well, and a lot of the early MOBAs were mods for RTS games, right? Like the first one was maybe Warcraft 3 mod or something like that.
Yeah, Defense of the Ancients was a Warcraft 3 mod, exactly. Yeah. So it's like it's just kind of in their genes a little bit. But yeah, you know, I think looking back, it's kind of like amazing that RTS games worked at all, right? Like they really put a huge level of demand on the players. And I think that's what kind of MOBAs discovered, is like people wanted to fight, you know, people liked, you know, having these battles basically, but they didn't necessarily want to have, you know, a resource management game at the same time. But also, resource management is fun, and maybe fun to have a resource management game without all the messy battles going on. So, you know, that's basically the game that we're trying to make.
Especially if you're like me and you suck at micro, and so every time you try to play an RTS and you're like really proud of the base you've built, and oh yeah, and I've got all these people gathering resources, and then some guy comes in with Zerglings and just screws everything up, and your economy is destroyed because you're not clicking fast enough.
Yep, exactly. And it's interesting because the game is real time and our game is fairly short form, it's meant to still fit that like 30-minute format. So because there is time pressure, there has still been kind of like micro elements that kind of slip their way into the design every once in a while. And every time we see that, we almost always try to figure out some sort of like high level of way to get around that. So, you know, like, for example, we have like an auto sell button. Like if you have a resource that you're just like, okay, this thing is just making money for me, I just wanted to be constantly selling that, we just give you that as like a one click option. So you don't have to be constantly like going back and forth and click, 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 clicking.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of smart things in the UI playing the game that would help focus your attention back onto making decisions and away off of sort of trying to do things quickly for the sake of proving how quickly you can do it. And one that I thought was an interesting one that made a lot of sense, but I was a little surprised to see it, was when you decide you want to place like a collector for a resource. So you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to put down this iron mine, and then it's like, okay, well, it draws a line from your colony to the closest, you know, really good iron mine, and then maybe a closer option, which is not as good, but it's closer, and it's kind of like, hey, you probably want to do one of these things. I mean, you can do whatever you want, but I'm just going to tell you, you probably want to do one of these things.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of games like, you know, StarCraft type idea is like, no, it's how quickly you evaluate those options and scan the map and look around that's making the difference in between, you know, win or loss. Whereas for you, it's the is more focusing on the strategy of it, which I really liked.
Yeah. I mean, from our point of view, you know, the game is 30 minutes long. So what do we want you to be, what do you want to be doing with those 30 minutes? And you know, when the decision you're making is that you're going to build an aluminum mine, it's not necessarily figuring out which one is the exact perfect one to do. And beyond that, like generally speaking, it's that choice. Like, do you want to take the small one? You want to take the kind of weak one that's closer or the big one that's farther, right? So we might as well just give you that information. You know, there's no reason to make you look at all 40 sources of aluminum on the map.
Yeah, exactly.
It's always nice to have those kind of hints in a strategy game, because strategy games are so much UI. Like, it's one of the things that sort of bothers me about them now, I find. I used to be a lot more into strategy games, and you know, anytime I fire up a new strategy game, it just always feels like there's so much stuff to do and so hard to know what you're supposed to be doing. So anything like that helps focus in on, you know, where the game's supposed to be going, I think is really helpful for getting people into the game. Whereas I think that, you know, lots of strategy games come across as kind of intimidating.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to, you know, focus your attention on what's the big thing. Like, you know, one of those things is like that that upgrade button, like in the bottom left in the game. Like, it's the biggest button on the screen, right? And that's because it's the most important button, right? And like,
and if you can click it, you probably want to try and click it.
Yeah.
Soon.
So yeah, as soon as it's available, like, it glows, right? Like, you know, we could have all the buttons glow once they're available, right? But like, this is the only one we have do that. So, you know, and that's the reason for it.
Yeah, and that I thought that in general, considering the topic of the game, I thought that the high focus on UI, or at least it came off as being a big focus. You had like two, like just full time people that were focused on the UI. Is that correct when you're on your team?
Yep.
And how big is your team?
Like 8 people, a couple of contractors as well.
Right. So that's like a really high proportion compared to a lot of games.
Yeah, it's like a quarter of our team, basically. Yeah,
exactly.
As opposed to most like AAA games would be like, oh, well, we've got this one intern who just started and, you know, we'll make him the one UI programmer on the team of like 30 developers.
Yeah. And that one UI programmer is going to have to, who like is an intern and you know, maybe is not very rehearsed at this, is going to have to fight off the marketing department, who's like, okay, so the menu needs to have this like giant animation that swooshes in and then rotates every time you change characters.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, that's gonna take like 4 seconds to change each character, and there's like 80 characters. No, it needs to be really cool and splashy.
I often tell people that like UI jobs are kind of like a secret like backdoor in the industry, because I've seen it all so many times. Like no programmer seems to want to work on UI. It always seems to end up falling to the guy who's the newest, or yeah, like literally to the intern sometimes. But I tell people who are programmers and who want to get into game design, if that's what you want to do, volunteer to do the UI, because like kind of like de facto you have become a game designer. Like you're going to be constantly making decisions about, you know, how the game works. Like, you're going to be the closest to the user of any of the other programmers, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, if you get good at that, you are slowly becoming a game designer, you know, whether other people realize it or not.
I think one of the reasons why that's sort of an issue of people not liking UI and not thinking about UI in games is it's the part of the development of a game that seems kind of the least gamey, right? Like all of the other areas of development of like graphics and sound and AI and like all that stuff, you know, that's what people are excited about in games. And so they feel like, oh, well, UI, like lots of people do UI programming that aren't doing games. Like all software has UI. So it feels like, you know, it feels like a not what I got into the industry to do kind of thing. Whereas, you know, as you say, it's actually, it's really important in games, if not in some ways more important, because most, you know, most UIs for conventional applications don't have the time pressure on use of the UI that games do, where you have to make those decisions and understand what's going on very quickly.
Yeah. I remember, I think this is kind of, we're past this now, but I remember there's a period of time, maybe 5 to 10 years ago, where it seems like it was just like this high level goal of so many designers to like get rid of UI entirely. They're like, oh, this game would just be so great if we could figure out a way to have no UI on the screen. And it's like, I don't know, people feel adrift, you know, like it's it doesn't help people understand what's important about the game. I mean, people know they're playing a video game, you know, they know that the game has rules and it has mechanics and it's got discrete numbers behind it, right? And you don't have to show them all to people, but like, they don't think they're looking at something real, right? I mean, it's important.
There was the extreme example of that came up many shows ago, which was the Jurassic Park game Trespasser. Have you seen that one? And they were like, it's going to be totally realistic, except, we need to kind of show the player's health. And so the best they could do with, and their goal was to have no UI at all. And so what they came up with is that you have to like point the camera down enough that you can see a tattoo of yourself that showed a heart that was like in various states of disrepair, depending on how close to dying you were. Which, maybe not the most intuitive way to show the possibly most important piece of information.
It's always wonderful that when there's high-level goals that are so inflexible that you just have to, like, jump through all these hoops to, you know, do the stuff that you just normally have to do.
So I thought that was generally an interesting, and one kind of related thing on that I thought was interesting in the UI of Offworld in particular was how for... In the UI, one of the fairly prominent things is it shows the rate of how much you're gaining or losing different things, which is like, oh, yeah, okay, so I'm gaining this much iron, okay, so I guess I maybe don't need any more. But there's like an interesting subtlety there, which is that because the buildings will consume iron until you don't have any, if you do the naive thing, it'll like fluctuate all over the place.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting thing that it was probably on designer notes that I heard you talking about how you resolved that. Like, what was the algorithm?
That thing gets a little weird. It's almost hard to explain because it's like once it works, no one thinks about it. But the process to get there was tricky. So the idea there was that, like, let's say you've got an iron mine which makes iron, then you got a steel mill which turns iron into steel, right? And the thing is, your iron mine might not produce enough steel to feed all of your steel mills, right?
Right.
So what you would see then is you'd see like minus one iron plus one steel, right? When everything was working. But then when it stopped working, it would be like plus one iron, zero steel, right? And like, if I explain it to you, you're like, well, yeah, that makes sense. You're just showing the correct numbers, right? But the issue is, people weren't just looking at those numbers constantly, right? Like, they would look at them randomly, right? And if they look over there and they see plus one iron, they're like, oh, I got too much iron. I better build another steel mill, right?
Now it's even worse.
Yeah, exactly. And so, we kind of fudged the numbers there where we kind of, the inputs, we basically show we pretend like all your buildings are functioning. Basically. But then we actually don't do that on the outputs. So we don't show that steel is being produced, but we do show that iron is being produced. And it was actually my our art director and my business partner who pushed me to do this. And as a programmer, it was like he really had to push me to do this because I'm like, we're lying to the player.
You know, like, this is not true. You're not actually at minus one iron because you have zero iron. It's just not logical.
Like I'm making up a number here, but like, once I put it in, it's funny. Like the brain, I don't know, you know? Some things you can't be sure of how they can work until you see them in practice.
As a player though, like trying to understand what's going on, I mean, to a certain degree, like that the board of the resources is kind of the game, right? Like, map is interesting and all, but really what you're playing is you're playing that resource board, and you really want that strong link of when I look at that resource board and one of those little numbers has gone red, like that, you know, that means something bad. Issue, right? You don't want things to be in the state where the number could be red, but it's not.
Yep.
It's not turning red, right?
Yep, absolutely. Although it's funny because there's also this next step, which is like it's very good that people get over that initial hump of understanding what all those numbers are. But then there is this other thing where I think a lot of players hit a certain ceiling in their skill level in that a lot of people play the game of like, I just want to get rid of all the red numbers, right? Like, I don't want to see any red numbers. I want to see all green numbers. That must mean I'm doing well, right? And that's fine. Like, that's a good way to start learning to play Offworld, right? Like, you'll do fine in the first few levels, but once you start playing against other humans who are doing all sorts of tricky things with the game, like, if a resource is worth $4 or $5, like, yeah, go negative on that, right? Like, don't worry about it. It's so much better to buy it off the market than make it yourself, right? Like, let someone else make that for you and just buy it from them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Is there a pool of, like, when those resources, is there a way for a resource to completely run out, or is there, like, a bank, so to speak?
Yeah, it's just simulated by the idea that it's kind of like your local gas station, which is that, like, yeah, there is only so much gas in the world, and obviously it would be theoretically possible for you to go to the gas station one day and there just not to be gas there, right? But, you know, the way commodities markets work is that if that ever becomes an issue, they'll just keep jacking up the price, right?
Until they don't run out of gas.
Yeah, until enough people stop buying gas so it's not a problem, right? I have seen every once in a while some people have kind of like issues with it where they're like, wait, I mean, you can just keep buying it, but well, where is it coming from? And it's like, well, that's not, yeah, that's not really the point, right? Like, it would be just a very different game if we did it that way. And that's actually more the way Mule worked, if you guys ever played that game.
I know of it, but I did not play
it. I think I played it like once or twice back in the day, but I never really got into it.
Yeah, it was just from 83, so it's quite an old game, but there's a lot of elements of Mule in Offworld. But that game, there's four resources, and like a number of people produce food, and you consume X number of food each turn, and if all the food was gone, like, that was it. And like, you didn't have enough food, and it meant the next turn, like, you wouldn't be able to basically make as many moves as everyone else. So it was a really big deal. And then what that meant is that, yeah, when you got to the end and there was like one unit of food left and there was two people who wanted it, like, that price could, there would be literally an auction for it, and the price would just go up, up, up like crazy. So there's interesting aspects about that, but like, for our game to work, we didn't want to get that deep on like the details of the specific resources and where they are, right? Like, it's a close enough approximation that if the price keeps getting high enough, people will figure out, like, okay, I got to stop buying this. I need to start making it now, right?
One thing that I found was interesting about that is that, like, I was sort of noticed that, like, okay, yeah, they're, like, even though we're supposedly on this other planet, there's just all this other stuff that we can buy. And it didn't bother me for most of the things, but kind of bugged me for power. Because, like, all the other resources, it's like, well, okay, there could be, like, supply ships or something like that. But, like, where's this power? If none of us have, like, solar panels.
None of us is making it, right, yeah.
Or geothermal or anything. Like, where is this power coming from?
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean, like, you couldn't treat power differently that way. Like, it would, you know, it would totally change the character of the game to try and be realistic about, like, okay, yeah, well, we can ship everything other than electricity to this planet, so people just have to make electricity. But, yeah, that I thought that was kind of an interesting, like, you know, sort of hole in my ability to suspend disbelief, is that really kind of bugged me that you know, power obeys certain laws that are different from other commodities but didn't in the game. But I know that's just me being irrational, and from a gameplay standpoint, like, it has to be like that.
Yeah. Well, it's fine to think about that, to you know, take a little bit of issue with that, because I mean, kind of what's going on here is that we had to decide where we wanted to set this game, right? Not just in terms of, you know, where in the, geographically or whatever the right word for that would be for Mars.
Where in the universe it is.
Yeah. But also in time, right? Like, you could probably easily imagine us doing this type of game, but setting it in, like, the New World, right? Like, in 17th century Caribbean, right? Like, that, we could probably make a similar type of game there. But we wanted a game that had kind of like, you know, a modern stock market, and it had energy, and had all these different other things that kind of like just fit well with like very fast transactions, right? So we felt like we needed it in the modern world, but at the same time, because it's a strategy game, like, it really is always great to have like an empty map, a plausible empty map, right? Like, we could start the game on Earth and be just like, hey, it's a big open area that no one has come to before for some reason, but there's lots of iron here and oil and grass and whatever. Like, you know, we could do it like that, but it seems like it was very plausible to say, like, okay, we've got this environment where there are a certain number of resources, and also there's going to be some sort of government authority that, like, limits how many claims you get. Like, it just seems like that fit Mars very, very well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And there's always those trade-offs, and that this like power is sort of summonable via money type thing.
Yeah.
Is one of those many little things where you have to make some trade-offs that all games need to do to some degree of realism versus being fun. Yeah. But strategy and simulation games really are up against this constantly, because I'm sure the Steam forums were full of people arguing why some little gameplay thing that they maybe don't like personally, or maybe they even like it, but technically it doesn't make sense that, but
yeah,
it's not fun if you make it so that if you run out of power, your buildings just shut down and then you can't make any money and then you can never make power.
If we had been on Earth, you wouldn't have had the same issue, right? Even if we were like on some like imaginary new planet location on Earth, like it'd be very easy for you to imagine like, well, there's probably just power lines off the map and you're getting them from somewhere else, right? Like you wouldn't have had that issue, right? That's that weird. The biggest area is by far the stock market, right? Because we have a stock market that like, if you don't look at it closely, it kind of looks like a real stock market, but then once you pay attention to it, you realize it's like, well, this doesn't function like any stock market, you know, anywhere ever, right? And that's because like it's really just a victory system. Like that's what it's there for. Like it's to find a way to tie up the game in a way that works thematically. And I think it succeeds at that. But if you come to the game being like, I want to learn something about how a stock market works, well, I mean that's not how this is gonna work. I mean I think you can learn from the game about just the base concept of like supply and demand and arbitrage and stuff like that, because that's just baked into like, you know, a system that has that idea of like, when you buy, the price goes up, when you sell, the price goes down. So I think a lot of that stuff is in there. But, you know, people who want to get very specific about like, this is a very specific way a stock market is supposed to work, like that, you know, that's just not the game.
I imagine that was even a whole nother level with Civilization 3 and 4 that you worked on, where there, you know, there was actual history that it was based on. You can't just speculatively, oh, well, you know, in this future world, this is the way things work. But you were still constrained by needing to make it fun to play each civilization. And that even though in history, the Romans obliterated this tribe or something, you need to be able to make it so that the tribe can compete and that they're roughly even. And
Well, the big advantage of Civilization, of that subject matter, is that a lot of your game mechanics, you know, like people will eventually like try to figure out what the details are, but a lot of stuff that people will make their choices because they relate to the stuff that's in the game. They understand if you're choosing between, you know, bronze working and writing, you know, what that implies. Like one implies, oh, you probably want to go fight a war, and the other implies like, oh, you probably want to develop your culture, right?
Right. So there's a certain intuitiveness there.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if it's not, you know, even if it's abstracted for the sake of funness in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've always found it kind of amusing, the strategy market, that, you know, there's a lot of what are termed, you know, 4X games, which are basically, you know, the Civ games, but also, you know, all of those kind of like space games, right?
That's like explore, expand,
exploit, exterminate, extinguish. Probably.
Yeah.
The ironic part about it is, you know, Civ is the biggest one, but it's like almost one of the only ones that's about history. You know, it seems like 70% of them are about space, and a few, then the rest of them are probably about, you know, fantasy, basically. And it's like all of those games about sci-fi, they're all missing like the great thing about Civ, which is that people can relate to it. You know, when you start one of those sci-fi 4X games, it's like, well, you have to learn, you're not just learning the mechanics, you're also gonna have to learn the theme. I mean, that's why that's why those games sell to a niche, as opposed to, you know, Civ 5, it sold 8 million units.
I think there's a real tension between the like suspension of disbelief aspect and the familiarity aspect there, that, you know, you kind of have to pick one of like, if you go with the historical stuff, you've got instantly relatable to people and they're going to understand some things about how the technology is going to work based on the real historical technology, but then you also have less leeway to make up your own rules for things. Whereas if you've got a sci-fi setting, you can just kind of say like, well, we're just going to make this, you know, resource that doesn't make any sense given the laws of physics, but it's important that we have it from a gameplay standpoint to make these particular balancing elements work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally true. And like off-world, we tried to kind of find some sort of a sweet spot kind of between the two, in that like it's, you know, it's relatable in the sense that it's like, okay, people understand Mars and they understand that like life would be hard there and you'd have to kind of like figure out, you know, how to make food and oxygen and whatnot. But at the same time, we could do things like we could have teleportation, right? Like, is, you know, is teleportation real? Like, well, it's, you know, maybe it's the future, right? So yeah, like we were able to experiment with some game mechanics that would have been trickier to figure out how to pull off in a game like Civ.
But at the same time, it does, you know, it does relate to people's understanding of how manufacturing functions, right? Of like, okay, yeah, iron is used to make steel. It's not like, you know, you mine Frostbosses and then turn them into Grubeldorps or something, right? Like that, where you need to learn all the rules from scratch. You know, most of the inputs, even if they're not, you know, even if they're not 100% real world accurate, at least relate to how those resources actually work in the real world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that has been a bit of a struggle for game designers. I don't know if it's becoming more so recently or I'm just becoming more agitated with recently, but this sort of making everything Frostbosses and things just because, oh, well, we're making our own world. And in this world, it is like the real world, except all the things you already know about the real world, you can't use to relate to it. So, you know, and like Destiny is the extreme version of that.
Sure.
Every single noun is a nonsense made up proper noun.
I feel like I'm lucky that I'm really bad at that. So I would like never even try to do that because I think that's just like, oh man, you know, I can only handle so many proper nouns, you know. If I start getting apostrophes and stuff like that, like it's just, you know, it's not a good feeling.
Yeah. And so in Offworld, we have iron and we have aluminum. And everyone's like, oh yeah, okay, I get those. That makes a certain amount of sense. One thing that I think we sort of were starting to touch on, but is an interesting puzzle to me when working on strategy games is balance. I guess in any game that has the potential to have different strategic choices. How much time did you spend on Offworld or in Civilization? Like what kind of place in the hierarchy of needs was balancing the different different strategies and different characters that you could play or civilizations?
Yeah, I mean, balance is tricky because it also kind of means a lot of different things to different people, right? I mean,
sure.
The simplest form is just like, okay, there's four different HQs in Offworld, right? Like, is there one that nobody ever picks, or is there one that like all the competitive players pick, right? And that's, I mean, that's kind of like the most obvious one you got to tackle, right? Like, because if you get that wrong, then, you know, you kind of screwed up that first step as a game designer, right? You know, if everyone was telling scientific, then it's like, well, look, I mean, I'm, you know, I really need to go back to figure out what's going on here. But that's also, in many ways, that's the simplest thing to solve, right? And we had, you know, we were in early access for a year, and we usually would have a major update every month, and we had some updates where it was basically like that, like everyone was basically playing one or two of the HQs. So, but you know, that's just something you hammer away at, right? You, like, all right, well, we got to give this guy some sort of buff, or we got to like take away this one advantage, or, you know, we got to keep working on that until the different paths are balanced. I think the trickier question of balance is kind of like the high level, you know, what are the different ways to play the game, right? Like in Civ, you know, that's the classic is like the warmonger versus the builder, right?
For
like,
sure.
Are those two things balanced? I think Civ, it's fortunate in that it's a single player game. So to some sense, we actually get around that. Like they're not really balanced because I think that warmongers play the game as warmongers and builders play the game as builders, and they don't necessarily pay attention to like whether one path is better or the other.
Also because it takes a long time to play each game.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, well, I'll play 10 or 20 warmonger games and then 10 or 20
and see which one's the best, right? Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, Civ is just much more of an expressive game. Like you're expressing something about yourself as you play it. Whereas a game like Offworld is, you know, it's much more of a competitive game, you know, where it's like you feel like you have to adapt. If there's a better strategy, you need to adapt to it. So that's one where Yeah, I think a lot about, for example, like the advanced buildings are something I think about a lot for balance, because that's kind of like the way I look at the different high level strategies, right? Which is, you know, there's the patent lab, which is something that has all these weird orthogonal techs, but then it has to be balanced with the optimization center, which is just very much more straightforward. You just want to focus on optimizing your production, you know. And then there's like the hacker array, which is like, I want to play with the on-world market versus like the off-world market, which is, I don't really care about the on-world market. I just want to start shipping my stuff off-world for the most money, right? And so like an ideal arrangement for me is if I saw four very good players go into it and they, you know, each of them chose a slightly different strategy. Yeah, I mean, that also just kind of takes experience. It's why I really liked being on Early Access, because we weren't just, you know, imagining that our game was balanced. You know, we were seeing people play it, and we really, we encouraged, basically, we ran maybe 8 or 9 tournaments during the game's development with our community, and that's something that, like, you know, I mean, it's a competitive multiplayer game, so people already get competitive about it, but as soon as you have like an official company tournament, people will get much more competitive about it. And the more competitive they are, the faster they're going to find the kind of like the holes in the game. You know, early on, some people figured out that, like, okay, if you build multiple hacker arrays and then you all hack just and have them all hack one resource at the same time, like, it would basically dwarf all other strategies.
Right.
Because, you know, it could, like, the hacker arrays is a super interesting building, but if instead of raising the price of something by $100, it raises it by $600, well, then you've just won the game. If you just get a stockpile of that thing and then do it, then that's it. So, you know, so we fixed that by just making sure you can have multiple hacker arrays, but you can't hack the same thing at the same time at all of them.
So do you feel like that was a data driven? Like, were you guys watching statistics over time and gathering, you know, oh, this percentage of wins the way they do at the scale of like StarCraft or something? Or is it more just people, you know, you observing the behavior in those tournaments and making sure there wasn't some thread complaining that focusing on all chemicals was just way too powerful?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really have the luxury of what Blizzard does, both because we didn't have the fan base, the size, the number of players to like make those numbers relevant, and at the same time, we also didn't have like a developer could just focus on doing that stuff. We were saving some stats, and I could kind of like download them periodically, but I would usually use them to kind of actually watch things like how were people completing the tutorials, and like were the levels hard enough or easy enough? You know, how many people were winning at employee, at manager, at VP, that type of thing.
So it was much more of based on observing those few testing events and receiving complaints, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it was more than observing. I mean, like, I'm the best players of Offworld. They're all on my Steam friends list, right? Like, I talk to them regularly. Like, we go back and forth on, you know, what the issues are and, you know, what they're concerned about. And you know, like, sometimes they say something and, you know, I have to be like, well, you know, I understand what your point is, but like, I respectfully disagree. But usually your assumption should be, if your community is saying something, you're probably the one that's wrong, not them.
Well, or at the very least, they're right about the problem, even if they're not right about the solution. Like, that's the biggest trap in those kind of community-driven things, or the two big traps sort of going in the opposite direction, is one trap is saying, like, well, you know, the players don't understand everything that goes into the game, so, you know, they don't get it. Or the converse trap is, like, because the players have recognized a problem, that means their solution is good. Like, it seems like the better strategy to follow is always, yeah, assume that if people are complaining about something, something's wrong, but don't assume that the people that are complaining have the answer, because they're always coming from it from their, you know, their very narrow local kind of view of things and can't always see that whole system.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a developer, so like, it's kind of like, it's just, to me, like, reminding myself that the players know the game better than you do is kind of like just one of those, like a, you know, personal mantra to just like keep reminding myself of it, because by default, I don't think we don't necessarily believe that, right? You have to keep kind of like reminding yourself of that over and over again. But like, as terms of like, in terms of like what the solution is, I mean, the way I look for that is like solutions can come from anywhere, right? But like at the end of the day, like that's my job as a lead designer is like, you know, I can figure out what the right solution is better than I can not come up with the best solution, but figure out what's the best solution because I feel like I'm the most, you know, I have the highest level view of the entire project, right?
Yeah, and you actually understand why someone say, oh, it sucks that you can't do this, and you know why you can't do this. And so you can take that into account as to, all right, well, your frustration is, you know, orthogonal to the proposed solution.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, a lot of things people suggest, like, it's just immediately apparent, like, why that wouldn't work if you've built the system yourself, right? But at the same time, you never know. I mean, a lot of good stuff has just randomly popped up. It's become particularly useful. Like the auto cell thing I mentioned earlier. There was just this one guy who kind of popped up from nowhere and just like this was his rant for like a week that he was just obsessed with this thing that the game didn't allow you to auto cell. And then he just kind of disappeared. And it just kind of like, it kind of stuck in my head for a while. Then I was like, well, you know what? There's really no reason not to do that. Like, I don't see how it would make the game worse. And it would certainly make the game easier for people who find that part of the game difficult to handle, right? So we tried it and it worked great.
So, nice.
I don't know. That's how things can be sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like you tell me, but it seems like the fact that a lot of the decision making is happening in the context of choosing a trade-off between resources and that the resources kind of auto-balance themselves in a competitive game probably helps you out a lot.
Oh, yeah, that part is great. I mean, that's one of the main reasons I wanted to make this type of game to begin with, was that some of the balance stuff, exactly, it just takes care of itself, right? Like, no one's going to be able to, like, oh, you know, electronics, they're the best resource always, right? Like, I mean, that literally doesn't work, right? If 3 out of 4 people go into one game all wanting to build the same thing, like, they're gonna all lose. That's why I really like this type of design. I think that you know, the free market is a really great place for gameplay.
Yeah, and auctions are the same way. That's another mechanic that you have, is that I don't know how much we should price this thing, but you will tell me.
Yep,
I'm like, okay, fine, I'll pay $20,000 for this claim.
Yeah, I'm notorious for overbidding on auctions in multiplayer.
Yeah.
That's one thing, if we did have a data team, I would love to see like the correlation between people who win auctions and people who win games. That would be really interesting. If it's inverse correlation or just noise, who knows?
Yeah, my instinct would be sort of leaning towards that people who win the auctions would win a bit more just because if they're in financial position that they can afford to be them up higher.
Yeah. That would be the hard thing to tease out. You're right.
Yeah, but you could definitely see that a lot of people are be like, no, I know claims are good. I'm getting this claim no matter what. And then they just overspend, and then they can't afford to do anything with the claim or causes other problems. So, yeah, I definitely enjoy that as a game designer.
Yeah. Auctions had a very different feel earlier before we had the debt system, because you had to buy with the money you had, which meant that at some point everyone hit a limit. And what you'd often see is like during an auction, you'd suddenly see all the prices drop because everyone was like selling their resources to be able to afford this auction. It was okay, but it was really great once, like, this is not the reason we came up with debt, but like once we came up with the idea of debt, at that point it was like, just put a price on it, right? Like, there is no limit. You can bid however high you think this thing is worth. It's totally up to you. Like, once there was that freedom, like, it made auctions super interesting.
I thought that the debt aspect of things was really interesting. I mean, maybe there are other games that have used that, but I'm much more used to the model of strategy game just being like, well, you've got your resources and you spend those. Whereas this, it was just like, no, like, this is, you know, this is part of a other civilization. Like, you know, if you look like you've got a reasonable business, you can go to the bank and ask them for money and they'll give it to you. And the fact that was sort of a, you know, almost like a seamless part of the game of you have to worry about it the same way you worry about any other problem, like a resource shortage or something like that. But you don't have to panic about money any differently than you do in any other resource, which seems like a very unusual way to do things to me.
Well, what's interesting about Dead to me is that it was, we came up with it for a very specific reason, which was literally like, well, what happened, you know, you need food and oxygen, right? What happens if you don't have it? Right. We had to do something. Right. So we came up with the idea of debt, but then once we did, it was like this thing that was, we could just use it for so many other things in the game design to make it, it just solves so many other game design problems, like the issue with the auctions. And then there's like the reveal map mode for multiplayer, which was something that like I knew we probably needed some sort of reveal map system for people who just wanted to play that way, but I couldn't figure out how to make it work until, you know, it kind of came up with the idea of like, oh yeah, you have sort of this like reverse debt auction. And like that just worked perfectly.
Yeah, it was unintuitive to me at first because my original mental model of debt in games was, well, debt is when you have negative money and then you can't do anything, like, you know, in SimCity or something like that. And you can go and get bonds. But then in a lot of games that allow debt, it's kind of almost just a way so that if you're going to lose, you lose slower. Mm-hmm. You take some debt out. But it pretty quickly, it helped that one of the tutorial screens was like, don't worry too much about having some debt. Like, it's okay.
Yeah. We have to, that is similar to that thing I mentioned earlier about like a lot of people that first level, they just want to like make everything red, green, right? Like that's the same issue of debt. And like, I got to pay off them all my debt. Because they're also I think a lot of games, especially ones that are long form games, they have a very like eat your vegetables feel to them, you know, that's like they kind of like they want you to make those long term investments, you know, which is great, right? I guess. But it's at the same time, like it means that if we have a mechanic called debt, there's just a lot of people who are just like, well, I got to make sure I avoid debt, right? Like that's obviously the last thing I want. But yeah, you have to learn to be able to use debt as a tool.
Yeah, which going back to the realism of things, like if people were actually doing this, like, you know, all the companies involved would be running up massive debts back on Earth to make these operations work, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And that's actually something that I had, you know, we run a small software company and my mental model of it was always have zero debt. Don't take debt for any reason. And being very proud of not having any. But as we've grown and now we have like 10 people and, you know, have a kind of non-trivial business, our accountants and, you know, a lot of the stuff I'm reading about, like, oh, how do you run a business like this? A lot of them saying like, oh, well, if you don't have any debt, that's kind of a bad sign because that gives people and, you know, people evaluating your business a sense that you're not actually taking advantage of economic opportunities that that might be there, and you're just kind of wasting them. Because if you're like, well, you know, we could do this project, but we would need to hire someone and pay them, and then we would, you know, make money once it was done. But oh well, we're not going to do that because we don't believe in debt. So it is actually there's a lesson to be learned in off-world trading. I don't know if I want the hundreds of thousands of debt in order to build speculative bets on the chemicals industry, but you know.
Yeah, the way some of our players usually put it when they're trying to explain how debt is good is that, you know, which player is going to be stronger, like a player who has $100,000 in cash and $100,000 in debt, or a player who has zero debt but also zero cash, right?
And can't do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and ultimately you buy your way to ultimate victory, right? So, you know, all that matters in the end is if you got everyone else's stock, then you know, you won. It doesn't matter if you had to go into debt to do it.
Yeah My favorite games are one where you have people with like the two like very different philosophies going up against each other. There was a really great game in our tournament just a couple of, I guess it was last week, where one player who is very aggressive with debt, he'll take on a lot of debt to like upgrade as fast as possible. He kind of like got in one of those debt spirals where he just kind of went a little too far and got in D debt, and kind of interest started accruing, and he had like 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, and his debt like was just, his stock price was just like plummeting, and he was like $6, $5, $4, $3. But at the same time, he was building up this giant war chest, and the other guy was like going the kind of like, he wasn't going no debt, but he was playing a much more standard game, right? And he just the guy whose debt was dropping, like it almost got to the point where the other guy should be able to buy him out. Actually, it did get to that point. The other guy just didn't realize he was in that position yet. But the guy who got the $3 stock price, he did win the game because he was like just barely able to get enough money to afford the buyout. But like if the game had lasted another like 10 seconds longer, he would have had like a dollar stock price. right? And that would have, you know, when your stock price is that low, like you can get be bought out for like, you know, $10,000 basically. So like he would have absolutely lost the game.
Are there any, I find those things really interesting too, is like competing different approaches and how they interact with each other. Are there any of those like rock, paper, scissors type interactions in Offworld where, you know, a certain strategy does well against this one, but it loses to this other one?
I mean, there's a certain bit of that, amongst kind of like the HQs, like the scavengers are really good on against the black market. The scientists, on the other hand, have like good protection against stuff on the black market, with the exception of, probably mutinies. With the exception of pirates, you know, because they often ship expensive resources across the map. Right. Those two HQs tend to have a kind of an interesting relationship. When I think of like rock, paper, scissors with the game, I kind of think of like the stock system, because there is kind of a little bit of the classic rush, boom, turtle aspect of an RTS game in that stock system, in that, to explain to people who haven't played the game, like there's 10 shares of stock available. And if your opponents buy six shares of your stock, which means they own over half of you, you're eliminated from the game. And that's actually like a way to lose the game fairly early. Like once you own five shares of your own stock, at that point, it's like, okay, now you have a controlling interest in your company, right? You own half of your shares. And at that point, the only way you can lose is in like, essentially like a hostile takeover at the end of the game, where like the other people come, the other opponents come and like they pay double for like the shares that you own. And then you're basically forced out. But the main thing is that majority buyout that I mentioned earlier, that's kind of like a rush. Like that's going to happen fairly early. That's going to happen during that phase of the game when people, the money people make, they want to use to invest in their HQ to make more buildings, right? Like you make money and then you invest the money in more buildings to make even more money. And, you know, you're building that economic engine, right? But at the same time, if someone chooses to, they could instead take that money to like buy into your stock, right? And take you out before you're able to get to level five and, you know, and boom, right? Like oftentimes there's this step from level four to level five we'll see people do, where someone will upgrade to level five and then get like eliminated by the other players because they rushed ahead too far. And everyone else saw that, oh, he just jumped to level five, which means he just spent all his money. He didn't buy up any of his own stock ahead of time. He's vulnerable. We're going to attack him, right?
I'd always assumed that an early game stock purchase would not actually pay off, but it makes sense that if the other person has so little cash because they've been doing aggressive upgrading, yeah, and you're able to get pretty close, they're going to get these warnings like, oh, your stock is getting purchased. But if they have no cash, like taking debt is just going to push down the stock price more.
Yeah, this is something you'll see more in multiplayer. AI doesn't do it a lot, kind of on purpose. Like I didn't necessarily want the AI to be super aggressive about this type of thing. I mean, it's hard for me to make the AI do it right, but I also don't necessarily think it's like
fun to die that way to the AI. Yeah.
It's not necessarily the experience a lot of people are looking for in single player, but in multiplayer, this is the way it works. Basically, you have to be very careful about like when you buy your stock and when not to buy your stock, and like there's literally that concept of like rush, the guy who like wants to buy into someone else, and like the turtler of the guy who like I'm going to take the time to buy up my own stock, and then the person who's going for the boom, who's like I just want to get to level five as quickly as possible to get up an off-world market, ideally don't do it so fast that other people take advantage, you know, notice that and then, you know, buy me out. So like that's certainly part of the game as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing that I had on my list that I thought was particularly interesting in the sort of development process aspect of it was how you'd started off as a more traditional RTS, like this sort of prototypes, like, oh, okay, so you have like an explorer unit that can go around and it reveals the fog of war and and things like that, and that you had to actually set up if I remember correctly, you're saying you had to set up how the resources actually got brought back to your HQ. Mm-hmm. And those are all the sort of things that we think of when we think, oh, okay, building an economy in an RTS game, that's kind of all the things that you do in that. But that... Removing those things in layers, the sort of basic assumption is, well, of course we need a system where you explore using a little, you know, thing. Yep. But then you're saying a lot of people are actually playing on multiplayer with just the map revealed by default.
Yep.
I'm not sure if I have like a question around that. Other than that, I just always find that fascinating how much that game developers often talk about the power of what things they remove from a game and how much that makes it better. Whereas players, especially like people I see talking about early access games that they're enjoying, often have this imagination that the more that gets added to the game, the better it will get because more features are better.
You know? Yeah, well, that's certainly not true. It's was an interesting process. I mean, I think the reveal map mode is a great one to talk about in that sense, because it's hard for me to imagine we would have ever started the project from there, right? It feels like it's a totally different game at that point. You know, it's like instead, like we started off at a very different point, and it just was like one step after another to end up somewhere very different. And I think that however different Offworld is, I think it's very hard to start making a game where you aren't, you know, at least a majority of the stuff you're creating is not pretty similar to something that you've already played before, you know. And that's what you would have seen in the early days of Offworld, is that like, oh, you've got this interesting, you know, free market system going on here, but actually the rest of the game actually looks kind of much more like a standard RTS, right? Because it's just hard to like invent the wheel from scratch, right? Like if you do that, that's kind of like when you're in that land of, you know, you're kind of like making that very speculative design doc, which can be a way to like come up with a lot of, you know, weird ideas, but like it's kind of anyone's guess whether they're actually going to work when you try to put them into a game. And so, you know, for at least for the way I've always worked, like you do start with something that's, you know, recognizable, but has something, you know, something particularly interesting about it. And then over time, as we just played it, like, you know, we focused more on that part that we found interesting and, you know, kept reevaluating, like, well, you know, do we need, you know, does this game need a fog of war? You know, does this game need units? Does it need all these different things? You know, do we need to select, you know, your faction before the game begins? Do we need all these things that we've inherited from RTS games, and how much of that stuff can we get rid of?
Yeah, and that stuff makes games way better what I've seen is when it follows that evolutionary path where at any given time you have a game that's plausibly fun, as opposed to if you're like, okay, what if there was a game that has these 18 different assumptions broken from what we know is fun, and then there might be a core there that is super fun, but there can be so many things that you haven't tuned right or that you don't understand the UI for, or parts that are unnecessary, that getting from totally in the middle of the desert to fun is way harder than getting from fun game that is beside your fun destination in a kind of iterative path. Like, oh, okay, and then we go to this kind of fun game, and then we go to this slightly more fun game. We go to this slightly more fun game.
Yep. Yeah, I mean we're all learning together, you know, in game development, and you know the type of games that we can make now are very different from the type of games that were made 10 years ago, because there's been a lot of interesting games that have come out that have changed the way we've thought about games and given us some examples of new things to do, you know, and that's great. That's where game design moves forward. I mean, it's very rare stuff just kind of like pops out of the blue, for sure.
Yeah, I'd be fascinated to see with what would, obviously you can never be tested, but if you went back in time and like gifted all of the game design knowledge that we know now to like people on the NES or something, you know, like I bet that some just completely mind-bogglingly fun games would have come out of those eras, and especially in the early 3D era, when people are like, how does a camera work? I don't know. Like, maybe you'll just push in this direction and the camera will go in the inverse of the direction that your joystick goes, and you're moving in one other direction, you can't even see where you're walking, you know? Yeah. And that's that stuff is now obvious now that people have tried all those things and found the fun in so many different areas. But it's definitely a continual journey where we're all finding that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can even see that within generations, like, you know, I didn't grow up with a lot of consoles, but like I could see that like as a kid, like the first games I played on the Commodore 64, like looked just completely different from what they eventually became like 5 or 6 years later, you know.
Oh,
it just, you know, within this, like, kind of like each of those sort of limited scopes that like a constellation generation gives you, like, it, you know, when you're starting out, like, everyone's just sort of like, you know, I don't even know what the right word, what the right verb is for it, but, you know, no one knows what they're doing, basically. You have to kind of, you know, you have to learn as you go. And, like, that, certainly that's true at a large scale, too, for the whole industry.
But you really see that playing, like, emulation games. Like, you go and play a Final Fantasy 1, and then it's like, oh, you can't pick up this thing because you have too many items. And you go into your inventory, and you have 97, you know, garbage boots. And then right. you have to one by one say, discard boots. Are you sure you want to discard boots? Yes. And then it kicks you out of the menu. And then you're like, open, discard boots. Are you sure you want to discard boots?
Yeah.
And you're like, how did I even remotely deal with this? Like, I have zero patience for this now, not just because I'm an adult, but more so because any modern game would, A, let me pick up a new pair of boots, probably, or have some sort of, you know, better way of dealing with this than discarding them without confirmed dialogue one at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting how some of the like faux retro games, you know, you play them and it's like, yeah, like you could have made like Shovel Knight is a good example of that, right? Where you look at like what's going on in that game and you're like, I feel like they could have made this game on like the Super Nintendo, but it wouldn't have been like this. It would have been way worse because there was a bunch of things that they hadn't, you know, that like platform game designers hadn't quite learned yet in the Nintendo, Super Nintendo kind of area.
Where you would have had three lives and then you would have gone back to the beginning of the game when you died. Yeah. Cool. Well, I think that's a fun coverage of off-world and strategy games. Where can people go, Soren, to find more about you and what you're up to?
Well, you can probably check out most of my stuff at designernotes.com. That's designer-notes.com. That's where I, that's where I can catch up on my podcast there, which I have a podcast series where I interview different designers around the industry. Usually have something out every month, if I find the time for it. You can find Offworld at offworldgame.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Soren Johnson.
All right. Awesome. Well, those will all be in the show notes. Thanks everybody for listening. If you have any suggestions, feedback, questions, topics you'd like us to cover or anything like that, you can send us an email, hello@upup.fm, or leave us a rating on the iTunes store. And see you next time. So, besides the chaos of launching Offworld, have you had the chance to play any other games?
No,
no, it's just like the vortex.
Someday soon, but not yet.
No. Yeah, you probably have like a year of games to catch up on.
Yeah,
now.
I'm well supplied in games, I'm afraid. Now, when like, you know, once you're a developer, you got less developer. Now it's just like, I mean, you know, well supplied in free games, right? Like,
oh yeah, know? Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what to do when it finally comes time to play them. So, yeah.
I just started playing Overwatch the last couple days, which they're doing the beta of, and it's interesting. At first, I was kind of baffled because it's like Team Fortress. Did you ever play Team Fortress?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So it's like Team Fortress in its sort of bones, and then it's like a class-based shooter, and it doesn't take itself overly seriously, and you need to work together and capture objectives and help payloads get from one side of the map to the other. But the characters are so different, and the game is so colorful and zany, and there's just so many, each ability, like people, explosions and beams and you're suddenly seeing through walls because one of your allies has given you wall seeing, and then it goes away, and then there's all the, every single character has like a warning that they're using their super, and so you just constantly hear like, it's high noon, and you're like, what does that mean? Okay, I died. All right.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot going on in that game.
I'm pleased to hear that you are also like experiencing that level of confusion, because I was starting to get a little worried that I'm just getting old and like can't hold enough stuff in my brain anymore, because it is a very confusing game.
I don't feel like it's necessarily confusing in the way that a lot of games can be confusing in a bad way. It seems like it's confusing because it is tuned for how much sensory input, you know, does somebody who gets the game want, and I feel like I'm, as I've been playing it more, I probably played it maybe 10 hours now, which is not a lot. But I feel like I've probably gotten to the point where the noisiest and most obvious things, I've been absorbing them one by one. And the things that I don't understand yet are less important, if that makes sense. So even though at first it's chaos, like I'm first figuring out like the control scheme, which is weird, but that's like the most important thing. And that the game kind of guided me towards doing that first, and then sort of realizing that I should, you know, the people on my team and who's on what team and what, you know, who I should be running away from and stuff. And I feel like I'm learning it in like a helpful order, as opposed to like Destiny, I got quite into, but it was initially confusing, not because I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing or whatever, but like in Destiny, for example, they don't highlight your enemies based on their like enemies and allies' colors. They just have a very, very subtle effect. I think it's just that your enemies have no name bar over their head and your allies have a name bar. It's like something really subtle. And so it took me probably like 10 hours to figure out who I should be shooting. So compared to that, I'm doing a lot better, but there's way more chaos. It's just ridiculous. But I think it has potential.
Yeah.
And then of course I've been playing Offworld.
Cool. Well,
although I've been mostly doing the single player stuff. It's the multiplayer sort of, does it do matchmaking based on your skill, or is it just kind of dump me into a game and I'm going to get
it? It'll do matchmaking based off of skill. Yeah. But there's some good players out there. So, you know, and there's it, we don't have the enormous player base. That would mean that you would probably always get a good match, but you know, yeah, I think it's at least worth trying.
Well, I imagine now would be a great time to go on and try that, because there's going to be influx of people trying it out for the first time, because it's like, oh, now we're out of early access. And so even people who had previously played the game trying online for the first time, or people who are trying the game for the first time. And so there's, I would guess there'd be more newbies in the pool than if I'd tried it three weeks ago.
It is true. When I look at the match logs, there's a whole lot of names I don't recognize being matched up against each other. So, yeah. No, I think it actually probably is a pretty good time to try it out now. What I'm saying is, like, maybe once of every five games, you might see someone who just seems like he's just playing the totally different game from what you guys are.
Yeah.
So, but then in a way, that could be kind of cool. Like, we have replays, so, like, you can watch the game afterwards to kind of figure out what happened. So that could be an interesting experience as well. You should also try, if you're going to play multiplayer, which I do recommend, like, you really should try the game on multiplayer. Before you do that, try the daily challenge, because that plays out in real time, and it also uses the reveal map mode, so it kind of like is a good way to get used to playing in the way it works in multiplayer.
Whereas the normal game, the campaign plays in real time, but it pauses for certain actions, whereas the multiplayer, of course, can't do that, because you don't want to pause everyone when they make certain decisions, because that would be annoying.
So that'll get you out of the habit. Plus, it's kind of nice to be able to see how your times compare with everyone else, and then there's replays as well there, too, so you can kind of compare strategies.
Yeah, that makes sense. How do you guys do? Does Steam provide some sort of matchmaking system that you can rank people with?
No, we had Stardock actually has their own matchmaking system that we're using.
Oh, okay, that's convenient. Yeah, we have this strategy game that we've been working on at Steam Clock on and off for the last couple of years, and toying with it and iterating it. And it's a little iPhone strategy game, but I'm pretty concerned that if I was to just put it up on Game Center, which is the default iPhone or iOS matchmaking system, it doesn't actually offer like skill-based matchmaking, or at least it never used to, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty sure there would just be some people that would find some dominant strategy and then just destroy everyone, and then no one would want to play. And then meanwhile, because we're not running the servers, we're not getting any stats, so we don't actually know how people are winning. So then we could create our own server that reports all the stats of the wins and losses that's redundant, but then we can't even use that for matchmaking. We can just try to go around and chase down and balance the strategies. And the idea of building that stuff myself is not very appealing either.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's not something we could have done on our own. It was only because they were able to basically do that for us.
Yeah. I know there are, or at least there used to be, some like mobile focused matchmaking systems like OpenFaint and stuff. But when Game Center came out, my understanding was that they mostly all kind of died because it was this free competition. Except the Game Center didn't then need to keep evolving, because there was this free, you know, it was kind of killed all the competitors. And so we'll see what they do there. Or we could just eliminate all dominant strategies and perfectly balance the game before we show it to anyone.